the underground bunker of the Civitas Studio in Raleigh, North Carolina, it's Civitalk with your hosts, Brooke Medina and Ray Nothstein. We're here to connect culture with civics, making it relevant to your daily life. And dare we say, existence at a time where too many are triggered and offended. So, relax, but buckle up, and let's wade into the deep end. What's really happening in your old North State?
Welcome to another edition of Civitalk, here with my co-host Brooke Medina. Today we're going to talk about how we have just embraced and jumped into phase two, how we've partied with that and relaxed and enjoyed it. We'll discuss the education landscape in North Carolina, how that's changing in relation to coronavirus, the politics of reopening. I bet a lot of you are just sick of all the politics, the back and forth, the bickering. We'll discuss mask wearing and the late Congressman Sam Johnson, an American hero that recently just passed away. Brooke, how are you enjoying phase two compared to phase one? It feels like we're kind of like the tortoise in this race between the states on reopening, but we finally reached phase two.
Yay, we made it. I mean, it's no phase three, but at least it's not phase one, right?
Yeah, so. I saw a limo. Kelly and the boys and I were at Pelicans, which you know what Pelicans is, right?
Yes, the snow cone place.
Yeah, there's one not too far from our house. And someone pulled up to Pelicans in a big stretch limo. So they were like rolling in with phase two. I have a picture of it. I haven't posted online, but they rolled up into Pelicans in a limo. That's, I guess, how they were celebrating phase two, Brooke.
I mean, enter phase two with some style. Why not? I love it. I love it. You know what? So phase two began on Friday, May. Let me look at the actual calendar here.
It was Friday. A revised phase two. Don't forget that. Remember?
Wait, what'd you say?
Remember, Cooper said it was like a revised phase two. We couldn't.
Oh, yes. Revised phase two began Friday, May 15th at 2 p.m. No, Friday, May 22nd at 5 p.m. And at 6 p.m., my husband and I had dinner reservations in downtown Raleigh. Wow. So we were like ready and rearing to go for phase two. And so we went to a nice restaurant called Vidrio with a couple of friends. And so we rang in phase two with that. But it was interesting because obviously all of our servers had masks on and the tables were socially distanced. So we had at least a table between each table. But you saw people walk in and it was kind of, I mean, my husband and I and our friends, we were just having a really good time and almost like nothing had changed. But then you observe the people there and you see this just kind of wariness on people's faces because they've been cooped up in their house for so long. They haven't socialized in this way for a while. And there's still that fear of the germs and the virus and everything. And so, you know, our servers, poor things. They were just really having a difficult time with their masks. Sometimes they keep slipping down and they had their gloved hands trying to pour water. So it was interesting, but it was a lot of fun and I'm glad we're here.
Yeah, I had my 3-year-old son, James, ask me the other day. We were supposed to go somewhere and they said, well, we can't. We have to wait a little bit while. And he said, is it because of the virus?
Aww.
I know. And it's like we've kind of been shielding him from all that and stuff. And I don't know if it's something he heard at school or he just overheard, you know, his mom and I talking, but he was like, is it because of the virus or the germs or something?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you think about it, our kids are processing this in their own little way. They're catching these snippets of comments from us adults or on the TV or radio, and they're kind of coming up with their own vision of what this is. My 6-year-old was, whenever he hears someone cough or like I let him drink after me the other day and he's like, Mom, I don't want to get COVID-19. And then he heard someone coughing. It was like COVID-19.
Yeah.
So anyways, I just thought that was kind of funny, but yeah, I think we're going to take a while before we actually get back to normal, but I think we're at least on a good trajectory. But I mean, let's not forget there have been at least 100,000 American fatalities as a result of this virus. And it's, I know there are a lot of people that are mourning the loss of their loved ones.
Yeah. It's incredibly sad. And just, it's heartbreaking to me, just some of these stories about, you know, looking back, and I know it's still going on, but from weeks ago especially, where people couldn't visit their loved ones in the hospital, or people passed away basically by themselves. And, you know, thankfully there may have been a health worker that held their hand or something, but it's just, it's kind of a terrifying nightmare to have somebody you love not just pass away, but that you couldn't be there with them, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I think that's just, that's the human side of this, is that there's still a lot of recovery, both emotionally and physically and economically, that is ahead of us. And so this is certainly going to take a collective effort and communities rallying around each other. This is definitely not the time to at least emotionally isolate from people. So, but you know, one thing that has really parents will tell you is that they haven't had time to emotionally isolate when they've got little kids at home, as you and I well know. And some parents are just now finishing up the school year with their kids. Even if they didn't anticipate homeschooling, they were doing it this latter part of the school year. And so let's talk a little bit about the education landscape here in North Carolina, what that's going to look like in the fall.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I think it'll be interesting to see, just because I know you've seen this too, Brooke, but there's been more evidence come out that maybe schools shouldn't have shut down. And of course, I'm not criticizing the decision to shut down, because we didn't have the science and the data that we have now, but there's basically no trace spreading of this in dorm rooms or in school environments, it looks like, at least just for some of the data looking back at it. But yeah, it'll be interesting to see what kind of social distancing policies will be put in place. I know my wife works at a university in North Carolina, and I think they're implementing mask wearing outside of your dorm rooms, at least in that first semester and stuff. So it'll be interesting if there's similar things in schools, social isolation measures, and will that be a deterrent for some people to go back at all? Will they choose homeschooling? Will they maybe look into different private school options if they can afford it? What do you think?
Yeah, that's the thing. So I was actually, there was a morning consult and Ed Choice poll that came out about 2 weeks ago, and it saw a 52% increase in approval of homeschooling since this virus. So first off, I mean, there's definitely more positive perception of homeschooling since this event. I think maybe people who weren't familiar with homeschool families had a different idea of how it maybe looked, and realized once they were thrown into it. And I mean, I guess homeschooling isn't probably the proper term to use here. I think we've been doing crisis pandemic schooling, most of us. But they've at least gotten a better idea of what homeschooling might look like. So I think we're going to see some parents choose that education option for their kids next school year, especially if their jobs were already allowing them to work remote and they realize that they can balance this. We might see that, but another change that we're certainly going to see, if the economy doesn't have a really quick V-shaped recovery, is probably a decline in private school enrollment. As many parents, I mean, we're looking at 14% unemployment rate. There might be a number of parents that can no longer afford private school, and so they may be forced to send their kids back to their district school.
Yeah, Bob drew that point out on our site.
Yep.
In one of his articles. I don't remember the title of it, but you can find it at nccivitas.org. It's a good, he does a good job of kind of shaking out what the educational landscape's going to look like in North Carolina. And certainly, I think that there's going to be some private school enrollment's going to be down, just because, like you said, I mean, people are going to be tightening their belts, even if they didn't lose their job. I mean, they may have burned through a little bit more of their emergency fund. They may have had one parent laid off, or they may have just had a situation where they don't have as much take-home pay. So you're exactly right about that. And, you know, in terms of the homeschooling, I don't know. I mean, I do think that you could see an uptick. North Carolina, of course, I think, aren't we like second or third? No, are we first when it comes to a percentage of the school age population that's homeschooled? Aren't we first?
Yes. Yeah. We have I think it's 7.4% of the North Carolina population of school age students is homeschooled.
Wow, that's amazing. Do you think that a long jean skirts will
Oh, we're going to see. Okay. If we're going to talk about supply chain in light of coronavirus, I feel like we need to shore up the supply chain of denim jumpers for the homeschool families just, that are going to be.
I know that. It's much different from the 80s and early 90s.
Oh, but I love self-deprecating jokes when it comes to homeschooling. As a homeschool grad myself, and one that homeschools or at least one of my children is still homeschooled. So hey, I will do it all day long. I feel like it keeps me humble.
Yeah.
So
no, I always tell people, if I was homeschooled, I'd be a neurosurgeon. You wouldn't even be listening to me on this podcast. If I was homeschooled, I'd be like the chief of neurosurgery at some hospital.
You'd be doing surgery on your brain.
Yeah, I know. Because I went to mostly public schools. That's why I'm here talking to you, Brooke. You know, I'm not chief of neurosurgery.
Ray.
No, I didn't.
What is that?
I didn't. I was. That was cut down on myself. You know.
But I'm sitting here with you.
Well, but you
were backpedal out of that, buddy.
You know what I meant, people.
Okay, but I do think someone should at least rib Ray, so make sure you send him an email, giving him a hard time about that.
Yeah, no, so, I probably wouldn't be a neurosurgeon because I had to give blood in college just to pass biology, so.
So I'm not allowed to give blood. I can't remember if I've ever said this on the show or not, but because I lived in Germany during those years where mad cow disease was prevalent, they have banned me from giving blood.
I lived in Egypt, but I think it's been too long. It's been long enough now where I can give blood again.
Okay. Yeah. They haven't changed the ban for mad cow in Germany. So,
So I know one of the big things, let me put you on the hot spot, Brooke. One of the big debates is that homosexuals should be allowed to give blood. What's your take on that? Because there's a big push. I mean, we talk about science in the news all the time. And of course, there's a higher rate of STDs in that community. Do you think that they should be allowed to give blood? They see this as some of them see this as a civil rights issue.
Oh, wow. That's a good question, Ray. But honestly, I have not given thought to it. So I don't feel comfortable actually giving a yes or no answer. I know that, I mean, we've seen a huge decrease in AIDS transmission. And obviously, there's ways of controlling that now. But in terms of other sexually transmitted diseases that you alluded to, I don't know. I think that...
But that was the reason that they were, I think, barred in the first place was the AIDS crisis. Because so many the blood supply became tainted largely because of the sexual transmissions in that community. It's just interesting to me because I always see that as like, we talk about science so much, but I see that as like a something that bleeds into social issues and sort of this civil rights era. And they want to, you know, they want to be treated equally. And they say they can't if they can't give blood. But I think it's still a CDC requirement that that bans certain sexual categories
behaviors. Well, so I actually, so my childhood best friend, her mom died of hepatitis C. She was on the mission field when she was pregnant with my best friend, and she needed a blood transfusion there in Haiti and got one, but the blood was tainted with hep C.
Yeah.
And she contracted that and died at UNC Hospital when my best friend was only 11. I was there. My best friend was actually staying at my house while her dad was at the hospital with her mom. And I spent the day with her as she began mourning the loss of her mom. And so my mom has had blood transfusions while on the mission field because she got in a horrific car accident and lost half of her blood supply. And so I am all for testing blood and insurance. Like, it shouldn't be a social justice issue. It should just be like, is this blood something that someone else's body can take and I can give it to them in good faith and good conscience?
Yeah.
Because it's going to help them rather than hurt them.
Yeah. The screening is much better than where it was in the 80s, but obviously there's still precautions that need to be taken. And I know when we lived in Egypt, we gave blood in advance so that the embassy supply was there in case we needed it. Now that was probably more for if you needed some kind of outpatient procedure, maybe not an emergency, but I did know that we proactively gave blood when we lived overseas in Egypt because the blood supply was not to be trusted in that country. So anyways, enough of that rabbit hole. any final thoughts on the changing education landscape? I feel like we didn't hit that quite good enough or didn't hit it in full stride. I don't know if you have any final thoughts.
Well, one thing I would say is that this is actually going to become a heated issue if the Department of Public Instruction and the Cooper administration insist on placing onerous restrictions on school next year, whether that be AB schedule days where kids, half of the kids go on one day, half another, or they decide to not allow cafeteria use, or they make the kids wear masks. Like, I think it's really going to come to a head as we get closer to the school time. And so I would just tell our audience, be on the lookout for some of these debates, because there's a lot of parents that I've heard from at least 200 something parents that have sent us emails this past week at Civitas expressing their concern over these potential policies.
Absolutely. And I think I look at it, you know, and I know they got to be proactive in some of these decisions they make schools. I know Kelly, my wife, is doing it at the university she works with. But I always tell her, and I know she has to be proactive and make these decisions. But I was like, stuff is going to be so different when it comes to the fall or when schools reopen. Just think of how things have changed, you know, before we knew more about this virus. I mean, we can all remember just basically a month ago when they were still talking about 1 in 2 million people dying in this country. And
yeah,
it doesn't look like it's going to be anywhere near that, thank God. And so it's just amazing to me, you know, all these decisions that are being made 6 months out. I think you need to be flexible because, look, I think a lot of stuff's going to change. There's more treatment options already. There's more data that we can rely on. Generally, I think things are trending in a positive direction. And I think that helps us kind of transition, Brooke, to this whole politics of reopening, which I'm just kind of getting sick of. It's a problem in North Carolina. I think it's a problem with the Cooper administration. I don't want to put all the blame on him, but I do certainly think it's a problem in the executive mansion. But we see this in a lot of states, where some states that have a low rate of infections are continuing to stay shut down.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, and this is the frustrating thing. I think that at the outset, which the American people, by and large, I would say, resigned themselves to the fact that there were so many unknown variables at the beginning of this virus that they were willing to flatten the curve for sure and stay home. But as the data began rolling in and we began seeing how this virus was behaving, and the way it was and wasn't transmitting, yet our political leaders were still placing these really burdensome restrictions on businesses and employees. I think people got frustrated and they began to wonder, is there anything to these conspiracy theories that we're hearing? Which I have my own thoughts on some of the conspiracy theories that are out there, and I think they're ridiculous. But when political leaders do not properly communicate with the public and provide sufficient rationale for their decisions that are really heavy-handed, they shouldn't be surprised when it foments distrust and discontentment among citizens.
Yeah, one of my big frustrations, Brooke, is the inability, or obviously they have the ability, but some in the media, not all in the media, but I wrote a little bit about this today on ncivitas.org, but how they keep fomenting kind of fear and hysteria with some of the data by talking about there's more cases, and they kind of pick on states that are reopening without giving you the full picture in terms of, you know, that there is, it looks like now that it's 0.4 is the actual mortality rate that we can kind of draw from our best estimates right now. And on top of that, you know, there's really no contextualization of the data in terms of the percent of hospitalizations are down, the percent positives are down of the general population. And so none of this stuff's contextualized. And we see this hysteria and people fomenting or posting on Twitter of crowds. But it looks like a lot of the stuff I'm reading, Brooke, is that outside it's very hard to have this coronavirus spread. So mm-hmm. To me, I think there's a lot of good news coming out. This, I just listened to an interview of a cardiologist, Dr. Michael Cunningham, on the Oxford Exxon podcast that comes out of Mississippi. He's in Ocean Springs. And he basically talked about how there's not going to be a second wave, partly because of heat, but there's other reasons, he predicted, partly because it doesn't really spread as easily as we thought. It's already trending down. It's going to continue to trend down. So there's a lot of positive news coming out. So kind of what I wrote today, Brooke, was I said that what North Carolina really needs to do is trust citizens more and really go to more of these are the recommendations we put forth, instead of just clamping down on certain or what seems to be arbitrary businesses and telling them they can't open it. Let's trust people to be precautious, still do the safe things, the hand washing, the mask wearing, things like this, instead of forcing certain businesses to stay shut down, which it seems kind of arbitrary, especially when you can still go to Lowe's and it's like wall-to-wall traffic in there. So that's kind of my thought, is I think we should be more of in a guidelines phase than a stay shut down phase, unless Cooper can just come out and really make the case and say, here's the hard science. But I feel like he hasn't really done that. I don't know if you agree or
no. I think that he has failed to effectively make this case. He keeps saying that we're following the science and the data, and he's referring to the DHHS. But even the way that the DHHS is framing some of these numbers, you spoke about contextualizing them properly, and it doesn't seem as if the DHHS is being completely forthright with the mortality numbers. Even though you can find this information on their website, but it's not something that the media has really highlighted effectively. But over half of the COVID-19 deaths have come from congregate living facilities, such as nursing homes and prisons.
Like 62%, right, in North Carolina?
Last I checked, it was 62%, but it's kind of fluctuated a little bit. It's consistently been well over half. And so that's something, when you're thinking about closing schools, yet half of the deaths are coming from people that are well over 65 years old in congregate living facilities. Closing schools just doesn't seem to ring the same the way that it did at the very beginning of this. Positive rates or positive test cases may be up at any given time, but someone always needs to ask, well, how many tests have been done? Let's look at this per capita, the cases now, and just make sure that they're getting the proper context. And I think this is where it's incumbent upon us as citizens and taxpayers and just members of a community to really do some digging into this and ask the hard questions about these numbers.
Yeah, absolutely. Completely agree with you. And it's just frustrating to me to see some of the hysteria, like, you want people to die and, you know, still going on. I don't know if you saw the clip. I know Dallas shared it. There's been others that have shared it all over social media, but I thought it was hilarious where it was the cameraman.
The cameraman didn't have the mask, but they're trying to
shaming people for not wearing masks. And it was an MSNBC reporter.
Yeah.
Publicly shaming people for not wearing masks, and his own cameraman wasn't wearing a mask. I mean,
but you couldn't see the cameraman. And so the passerby walks across the screen during the live filming and said, well, your cameraman's not wearing a mask. He totally got called out. It was kind of nice to see. Well, that's the thing. And when some of the news outlets keep posting photos of Joe Biden at the Memorial Day ceremony, and he's wearing a mask, even though he's not really close to anybody while he's outdoors, and President Trump isn't. And they're making this just such a political issue, a virtue signaling issue. And believe me, hey, virtue signal all you want. I don't care. I mean, you know, we all virtue signal in some way or another where we're saying this is a virtuous behavior, this is not. But to make it just the pettiness surrounding some of this mask stuff is shameful. And if someone's not wearing a mask, maybe they're doing it because they've got a different health condition. Maybe they've got asthma. Maybe they've got some other sort of lung issue or respiratory issue. And if someone is wearing a mask, then be polite and conscious of that and don't look at them as if they're any weaker of a person either. So. That's my defense.
I think you're exactly right. I just get kind of fatigued by the fighting over the masks and stuff. And I'm one of those people that, you know, if it helps us get back to normal, not a new normal, but normal, then I'm all for people wearing a mask. If that's one of the things that makes us, you know, I don't understand like the people who are saying, I'll never do it and it's against my rights and this stuff. No, I mean, if it helps us to get our economy running, get people back to work, to normalize things, if a business requires that you wear a mask, then just comply. I don't think it's an undue hindrance to your lifestyle. Now, if you have a certain medical reason that you can't or that you shouldn't, and that's probably rare, but I'm sure it's out there, then that makes sense. And there certainly should be some flexibility for that. But the people that are like, that's going to make that's their hill to die on, I just don't quite understand. And I'm a pretty like live and let live kind of person. But that to me is a little bit ridiculous that someone would just sort of like make that their hill to die on and all the things going on.
Right. Yeah. Well, I've had a number of Facebook conversations or, you know, polite debates on this with some friends. And I think that really it's just, like you said, if these are the safety protocols that private businesses are requiring, and maybe they don't even necessarily believe in the effectiveness of the masks, but they know that a lot of their customers won't shop there because they don't feel comfortable without a mask requirement, then in order for them to provide jobs for their employees, they're going to require masks. Then, I mean, just look at it more full pictured, I would say. I don't believe the government should require the masks, but I believe private businesses, if that's what their consumer base wants, then, you know, I understand why they would require it. And so far, only maybe about 20% of the businesses that I've been at lately, because I went to the mall the other day, I've been at a couple of restaurants and then the grocery stores, maybe, you know, one in every five or so requires a mask to go in.
Yeah. And I noticed like some of the workers at Walmart and Costco, sometimes they have their masks around their chin, which I understand. They've been working all day and they're hot and they're tired. But I'm also like, yeah, you know, like if it's like, yeah. don't make them wear it if they're just going to wear it around their chin, I guess.
You either go all in or you don't wear it at all. Yeah. So, yeah, my daughter, she works in a food service and so they have to wear masks and she comes home with a lot of different stories about kind of crazy behavior on both sides of the mask issue. And there will be some people that one lady, she had a hearing problem. And so she was asking my daughter to take off her mask because she couldn't read her lips. And so there was that. And then there was another lady who she like when my daughter was trying to get the payment from her, she only cracked her window like an inch and she sanitized the credit card as soon as my daughter gave it back and then like changed her gloves as soon as that was over. It was just abundantly cautious in that way. So
So I wanted to close out by mentioning Congressman Sam Johnson from Texas, a former congressman. I believe he retired in 2018. Don't know that exactly, but I met him one time when I was up in Washington. He was a POW in the Hanoi Hilton. His story, he wrote a book called Captive Warriors, which I read. And these pilots, so many of them that were shot down in Vietnam and tortured in the Hanoi Hilton, are real American heroes. So I would just suggest people, if they have a chance, go read his book, Captive Warriors. It's amazing the amount of sacrifice that these individuals, many of them dying because they're older than the, you know, the draftee or the younger age of Vietnam veterans, because they're closer to the World War II age. They're officers and pilots in the Air Force and Navy, primarily some Marine pilots. But go read his story. Amazing man, and really somebody who just they really sacrificed so much for this nation. When they were held prisoners during the Vietnam conflict at the Ho Lo prison in Vietnam. And one thing I just always appreciated about Sam Johnson, of course, him being a conservative, I was an admirer of his political views, but he was a genuine person. And we don't have a lot of that in Congress anymore. And he was a very amiable person, had a strong faith, had a strong a way about him, I think, of just kind of advocating for Americans and trying. I think he was a member of the Freedom Caucus, trying to deal with the debt, trying to do all these things that have spiraled out of control. And a lot of those lessons of leadership he learned in the Hawaii Hilton. And I think it's incumbent on Americans, because it's kind of slipping away from us from a time period, to learn about these men that served in the prison camps. Of course, John McCain was the most famous, but many of them are passing away or have already passed away. And I think learning their stories are important, because we've kind of lost a sense of sacrifice in this nation. We see this with a lot of the selfishness going on at this time, or people melting down, or people saying that they're a victim when they're not really a victim. So I think it's important that America kind of embrace and understand a sense of self-sacrifice, sacrifice for a higher purpose and a higher cause. And it pains me to see that a lot of people, not all people, of course, we still got people sacrificing in the military and sacrificing in other ways, but it pains me that we've lost a lot of that sense of sacrifice and why it's important in this country. A lot of it's just me. I want my government money, or I want this and that. And, you know, these people that served in the prison camps sacrificed a lot. A lot of them were permanently disabled from the torture they underwent. So I just think, Brooke, it's important to learn their story.
Oh, absolutely, Ray. And that's a really good tribute to him and to the many, many others that have undergone just unthinkable tortures and difficulties and challenges for the sake of freedom. It's something that my husband and I, we sat down with our kids on Memorial Day and just shared some of the stories of people that we personally know that have paid the ultimate price. And, you know, we want to make sure that their memories live on, and that our children and the next generation writ large see good examples of what it means to be selfless. That's a virtue that we certainly need to continue to cultivate if we want to continue to remain free. So thank you guys so much for listening this week and joining us. We certainly appreciate it. And we hope that you have a wonderful week. And we look forward to talking to you again soon.
Yes, thank you.